This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. We begin with growing optimism that an agreement is close on a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages. We've been here before, of course, but could this time, as ever, with caveats, be different? Mediators in Qatar are said to have given the final draft of an agreement to both Israel and Hamas after a midnight breakthrough, with both sides talking of progress. But there's little detail of what progress means. Sticking points in the past have included whether an initial truce would lead to a permanent ceasefire and whether the Israeli military would commit to fully withdrawing from Gaza. Speaking at a news conference in Jerusalem, the Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said Israel wanted a deal.
Progress was made. We see some progress in the negotiations. Israel wants a hostage deal. Israel is working with our American friends in order to achieve a hostage deal. And soon we will know whether the other side wants the same thing.
President Biden spoke by phone to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday, urging an immediate ceasefire in what is the final week of his presidency. And speaking in the past couple of hours, he said a deal was near.
We're on the brink of a proposal that I laid out in detail months ago, finally coming to fruition. I have learned in many years of public service to never, 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 ever give up. We're pressing hard to close this.
Well, Sir Donald Trump, he's warned Hamas that there will be hell to pay if hostages are not released by his inauguration on January the 20th. The Middle East envoys of both men have been involved in negotiations in Qatar. So has next Monday become a putative deadline for reaching a Gaza ceasefire agreement? Aaron David Miller is a US Middle East analyst who served successive administrations as an advisor on Arab-Israel negotiations.
I think it has. Whether it actually happens before January 20th or a few days after, I think is largely irrelevant. It is the uncertainty of a change of administrations that I think has, to some degree, unnerved both Hamas and particularly Mr. Netanyahu. Since the U.S. in a Trump administration definitely has leverage that can be used against the Israelis should Mr. Trump choose to do so. So, yeah, I think both Hamas and Netanyahu somehow sense that they won't be able to play the Trump administration the way Yahya Sinwar and now his brother Mohammed Sinwar has played the Biden administration in these negotiations. So, yeah, if there is urgency, it is certainly partly a consequence of the change in administrations.
I mean, a deal concluded this week would be to Mr. Biden's credit, would it not? A deal concluded a couple of days after Mr. Trump's inauguration would be to his credit.
This is a matter of how this is orchestrated. Yes, the Biden administration will claim, if it happens before January 20, that they have, rightly so, they have done most of the negotiating over the course of the past year. But Mr. Trump is going to orchestrate this clearly as a major victory and as a reflection of the degree which American allies, namely Israel, American adversaries, namely Hamas, are very responsive to his threats and to his brilliance as a decision maker.
But it's interesting that the Middle East envoys of both the outgoing administration and the incoming administration are in Qatar for these negotiations.
I must tell you, Julian, that having worked for half a dozen Republican and Democratic administrations, I've never seen a transition in which an uninaugurated president and his still yet unofficial Middle East envoy is playing such a visible role in these negotiations. It's really remarkable. It speaks well to some degree of the way you would expect a functional, productive transition to actually work. But it is still extraordinary the degree to which Mr. Trump's image and shadow hovers above all of these proceedings.
Hamas, you seem to be indicating, needed a deal now quite badly. Israel, though, not so?
I mean, I think Mr. Netanyahu is emboldened by Israel's recent military victories. Mr. Netanyahu is also, I think, more emboldened politically. He has a safety net. If the two extremist ministers in the coalition should somehow bolt, he'll still be able to govern. I also think that Mr. Netanyahu wants to change the pictures. He wants to focus the Trump administration not on Gaza, but on his real priority, which is toughening up American policy toward Iran and perhaps even getting the Trump administration to acquiesce and or join an Israeli effort to destroy Iran's nuclear sites. I think that is what is driving him more than any other factor. And that means giving Mr. Trump a victory, which he is all too eager, it seems to me, to claim. And it will be perceived to be his first victory, which Mr. Netanyahu has facilitated.
And finally, as a veteran of such negotiations, what's the feeling in your bones?
To borrow from the British, it's a long way to Tipperary with respect to ending the war in Gaza. This is a limited deal, even though it may commit itself to three phases. And I think Mr. Trump is going to be left with Hamas still in control of at least 40 or 50 hostages, primarily IDF soldiers, both dead and alive, and an Israeli government that is will have very little difficulty arguing that the war against Hamas is going to continue. So Gaza is going to remain an extremely difficult and problematic issue for the Trump administration, certainly for the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza, and for the Israeli government.
U.S. Middle East analyst Aaron David Miller speaking to me from Washington, D.C. With Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu must first sell any agreement to members of his right-wing government. 10 of them have sent him a letter opposing a deal. The far-right finance minister Bezalel Smotrich has called the proposed deal a catastrophe for Israel's national security. However, Mr. Smotrich has had to contend with the anger of members of some of the hostages' families, who today squeezed into a parliamentary committee room to accuse him of abandoning those hostages still being held in Gaza. Hannah Cohen's niece, Imbar Hyman, was killed in Hamas captivity. She was one of those who confronted Mr. Smotrich.
Where is your shame? You murdered our girl and you sit here and calculate prices? Where is your shame? Are you not ashamed, Minister Smotrich? You will bring our girl home because had she been your girl, she would have been home long ago.
I spoke earlier to Jonathan Dekel-Chen, whose son, Sagi, an Israeli-American, was abducted by Hamas on October the 7th. I asked him, first of all, when he'd last heard about his son.
Your listeners may or may not know that Hamas and the other hostage takers have never allowed the Red Cross, Red Crescent, or any other international organization to visit with any of the hostages. So the little that we have was from the testimony of hostages who were released over a year ago in the first negotiated agreement. So the last sign of life that we have from Sagi was from late November, early December of the 100-plus hostages, women and children, who were released at that time. A number of them had encountered Sagi very briefly in the tunnels under Gaza and were able to tell us at that time, 13, 14 months ago, that he was alive at that time.
So you live in hope?
Well, we live in terror, actually. You know, the fact of the matter is that those same women and children were able to tell us from our community that they had encountered many other men who were left behind because they weren't included in the hostage deal. And many of them were murdered by Hamas in subsequent months. So we have always been very frightened for the fate of our loved ones, and that only grows with every passing day.
Today, though, do you feel differently? Do you feel as if some kind of ceasefire agreement, hostage release deal is closer than it has been before?
Well, I think, you know, you and the media know about as much as I do in terms of the details. You know, at the end of the day, this depends essentially on the will of two people. One of them is probably Mohammed Sinwar in Gaza, and the other is Benjamin Netanyahu. And I can't even begin to think what goes through the mind of you know, a terrorist sitting in tunnels under Gaza. I want to believe that, you know, with the added pressure brought to bear by President-elect Trump, that Prime Minister Netanyahu has come to the conclusion that it is in the best interests in Israel and of himself to make sure that, at least from Israel's side, we have gotten to yes. And then that's very important in terms of the fate of this agreement.
So do you share the anger, therefore, of the members of other hostage families at Bezalel Smotrich, who is opposing a proposed deal?
Well, you know, I don't know the finance minister personally. It's for me, it's not so much about personal anger against him or anyone else. It's more about our vision of what Israel is supposed to be. And among other things, it is a country that's dedicated to the preservation of Jewish life. And, you know, given the catastrophe of October 7th, for which he, as a member of the cabinet at that time, it does bear responsibility, it is just incomprehensible to the vast majority of Israelis that still, 15 months into this war, people like the finance minister still believe that there is an advantage to continuing this fighting and further risking the lives of our hostages and putting in peril, of course, the lives of Palestinian civilians.
And can I ask you very briefly, you've been invited to President Trump's inauguration. Will you be going?
And depending on the developments between now and then, yes, I'll be attending the inauguration with my son's wife, who will be accompanying me with two of their three daughters. It's important to note that Sagi is a father of three little girls, one of whom he's never met, and we await his homecoming.
That was Jonathan Dekel Chen, whose son Sagi was abducted by Hamas on October the 7th. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The BBC has found that workers in Chinese factories making clothes for the fast fashion giant Shein are labouring more than 75 hours a week in contravention of the country's labour laws. These working hours are not unusual in the southern city of Guangzhou, but the BBC's findings will add to a growing list of questions about working conditions in its factories. Our China correspondent Laura Bickers spent the day speaking to workers from dusk till dawn in the so-called Shein village to try to find out how the company makes its cut-price clothing.
We're in the beating heart of a global empire. The machines seldom stop in this factory, producing clothes for the fast fashion giant Shein. The workers listen to podcasts or cooking shows as they stitch or steam fabric. More than a dozen workers told the BBC they do this for 75 hours a week in contravention of Chinese labour laws. Most have only one day off a month. Outside, scooters rush through a warren of more than 5,000 factories, which make up the so-called Shein village in Guangzhou. At a nearby job market, workers looking for a daily paycheck examine the stitching of the kind of clothes they'd be expected to make. They get paid per piece. Their skill and speed dictate how much they make.
What do you usually make?
It depends on how difficult the item is. Something simple like a t-shirt is 1 to 2 yuan per piece, and I can make around a dozen in an hour. We earn so little. How is that enough? The cost of living is now so high.
Workers travel thousands of miles to Guangzhou to earn money to send back to their families. Shein is now one of their major employers.
I work with Shein at their first year. I watched it grow. I think Shein will get stronger and better.
There's an almost constant supply of fabric from nearby vendors. Shein's success has been possible because this city in China has everything it needs.
We've come to the textile district of Guangzhou. It's only about 10 minutes from the actual factories. And it is bustling this lunchtime. There are dozens of workers lifting heavy rolls of fabric onto trucks, onto cars, and onto, would you believe it, scooters. Now, I have no idea how they are balancing it, but on one scooter, there's at least 7 rolls of fabric.
Later, as dinner time approaches, street vendors set up stalls selling food, or even offering haircuts for workers on their dinner break. Long hours are simply a way of life, and a 75-hour week is not unusual in this industrial heartland.
Well, it's not unusual, you say, but it's clear that it's illegal and it violates basic human rights.
David Hatchfield is from the Swiss advocacy group Public Eye, which has also uncovered excessive working hours in factories producing clothes for Shein.
It's an extreme form of exploitation that happens, and this needs to be visible.
In a statement, Shein told the BBC that it is committed to ensuring the fair and dignified treatment of all workers within its supply chain. And Shein says it's investing tens of millions of dollars in strengthening governance and compliance. Shein also said it was striving to set the highest standards for pay. As workers head in for the last few hours of their shift, some tell us it's their duty to work hard.
This is what we Chinese need to sacrifice for our country's development.
It's just gone 10 p.m. and finally some of the factories are beginning to empty. They're filing out, jumping onto their scooters and heading home. They won't live too far away. Many of them have dormitories nearby or they live in small apartments. But I'm standing outside one factory that is still going and deliveries are still happening. It seems in this part of China, the textile capital of the world, is not a place that ever fully goes to sleep.
That report by the BBC's Laura Bicker in Shein Village in Guangzhou. And staying in the world of fashion, because the man behind some of the most recent distinctive and controversial advertising campaigns of recent years, the Italian photographer Oliviero Toscani, has died at the age of 82. He reached the peak of his fame in the 1990s with his work for the clothing brand Benetton. Among the most eye-catching images he selected, one showed a shockingly emaciated anorexic model, he said, to decry the fashion industry's demand for painfully thin women, and also a man in the death throes from AIDS at a time when the disease was still widely stigmatised. Carrie Jacobs was the founding editor, along with Oliviero Toscani, of a magazine Benetton produced back in the early 90s to go alongside its campaigns. She told Newsar about her unwitting role in the selection of these controversial images.
One day, I was called into Tibor Kalman's office, and they had a pile of photographs, Tibor and Toscani. And they said, look through these photographs and tell us which ones you think are the most shocking. And so I was sort of sorting them into two piles, like horrific and not horrific. And the ones that were in the horrific pile, like one of, it was like a mafia hit car bomb, and the one of the man dying of AIDS, those are the ones that became the ads. I think that Toscani wanted to change what advertising was. He was known for doing these ads that were just saccharine sweet. And I think that he thought that he could break through in a way that perhaps a news photo on a news show couldn't, that he could reach people with these images through advertising that they otherwise wouldn't notice. But he was right. I mean, those images were around. They were images that had been shot by news photographers, and maybe people had looked at them, but not the way they did when they were run as ads. I think that, if anything, he was exploiting Benetton's money to do things that he thought were important. I didn't always agree. I was kind of horrified when I realized that the ads that I put in the "this is too grotesque" pile were the ones that wound up in the ads. But I think that he had the trust and the assets for a long time of Luciano Benetton and was able to do these projects.
That was Carrie Jacobs talking about her colleague Oliviero Toscani, a photographer who has died at the age of 82. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes after a short bulletin of world news. You're with NewsHour. One of the world's largest religious festivals is underway in India, the Kumbh Mela, which happens every 12 years. Over the next 45 days, officials are expecting 400 million Hindus to make their way to where the three rivers, the Ganges, Yamuna and the Saraswati meet. Devotees believe their sins will be washed away if they bathe in the waters. Samir Hussain reports.
It's 5:15 in the morning. It's still very dark out, but you can hear chanting echoing everywhere. Many are making their way to the Ganges for morning prayers and to take a spiritual dip in water. I'm walking with Vinod Singh and his wife, Sushila. There are more than 100 people that are bathing at this particular spot along the Ganges River, and it's quite a lovely scene despite the morning cold. People are chatting, some start chanting, many have come with families. I see a young boy, can't be more than 12 years old, who's also taking a dip. There's a real community atmosphere.
आंटी आपने अभी नहा के आए हैं आपको कैसे लगा
बहुत अच्छा लगा है हमें और अब नहा के आई हमको ठंड नहीं लग रही है
She just said that she has gone into the water and she feels really good that walking here she was feeling quite cold but when she went into the river she didn't feel cold anymore Now there are religious ceremonies happening everywhere here The fairgrounds of this Mahakumbh Mela are enormous, more than 15 square miles. That's about 4,000 football pitches. There are thousands of cloth tents dotting the expanse of fairgrounds, and I've come to the tents where Vinod Singh and his wife will be staying for the next month.
So I'm looking inside of his tent. It's quite cozy in here. You see a bed area. He basically has a bunch of blankets and pillows. And then on my left, I can see he's got a stove and some fresh water. It's actually quite lovely in here.
Faith is what brings so many people here. But it's the sense of community that makes people want to stay.
Samir Hussain reporting from Uttar Pradesh in northern India. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Firefighters in Los Angeles are expecting the winds to pick up again as they continue to battle three blazes. As well as destroying thousands of properties, the wildfires, which have been raging for almost a week, have claimed the lives of 24 people. And the Los Angeles County Sheriff, Robert Luna, said the number of dead was likely to rise. He said officers were searching for missing people area by area.
We are in the third day of grid searching. It is a very grim task. Unfortunately, every day we're doing this, we're running across the remains of individual community members. That is not easy work, very sad to report, and I believe that work is not only going to continue, but I believe we'll continue to find remains. So please be patient with us. People are saying, I just want to go look at my house and I want to see what's left. We know that, but we have people literally looking for the remains of your neighbors. Please be patient with us. There is a lot of hazards in the area. Still, the area has not been rendered safe.
Well, among the 24 people who have reported to have died is 32-year-old Rory Sykes, a child actor who starred in the late 90s TV show Kiddie Capers. Rory had cerebral palsy and struggled with mobility. His mother, Shelley Sykes, has been speaking to our correspondent, Emma Vardy.
The fire actually came behind the property and the smoke was just intense. At 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning, they sent the emergency, you've got to evacuate. So I wrapped myself up, went up to the cottage and said to Rory, come on, we've got to either come to the house or let's jump in the car and go down. And he just didn't want to leave. And I raced to the fire station up the road and I got out all of flustered. And they said, Shelley, what are you doing? You're supposed to have evacuated. Within an hour, they came back and said, we want you to come up. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, they haven't brought Rory back with them. So when I got there, I had the shock of my life. Three cottages within an hour had burnt from top to bottom. The biggest fear I had was that it might burn and hurt, because I think burning must be the most painful death. And the fire department chiefs said, no, he will have died of carbon monoxide poisoning first, which made me feel a bit better.
He would have gone to sleep first.
He'd gone to sleep first and he would have stopped breathing. And so I just can't believe my baby's not going to be here.
That was Shelley Sykes, mother of 32-year-old Rory Sykes, one of the 24 so far to have reported to have died in the Los Angeles fires. Well, despite the wildfires, nearly all public schools across the Los Angeles area are expected to reopen today. At least seven of the more than 1,300 schools will stay closed. Four were destroyed in the Palisades fire, which is still burning. Bonnie Brimicum is principal of Odyssey Charter School in Altadena, which was among those burnt down.
It is a complete ruin. Unfortunately, we did have one of our eight buildings still standing, but they're saying we're not going to be able to occupy that building for close to a year due to the, you know, unsafe conditions, unsafe breathing. The water's been affected and the building is unstable.
And when did you become aware that the fire had reached your school?
Unfortunately, we heard from our families first about their homes and their loss. And only when we'd heard several stories that we put it together that that's the area that our school is also in. So we heard through our families that our buildings had been destroyed.
So these are families who were in the catchment area for the school.
Right. Yeah, we've had over 60% of our families report that their houses have been destroyed. And we still have a majority of our school we haven't heard back from yet. So I know that number is going to get even higher.
So that's a terrible situation. A school burnt down, and right. In all likelihood, when it does reopen, you won't have the same students coming to it.
Right. It's a possibility. But so far, from what we've heard from our families that we've been right here in contact with, because we're providing daycare and opportunities to come together as a community, that most are rallying back with us. They want that consistency for their kids. They want to be with the teachers that know them. They want to be where they're known beyond just this tragic incident.
But I would imagine that your students, wherever they happen to be at the moment, will have found this past week very traumatic, especially if they are among those families who've lost their own homes.
Oh, it's been awful. We have, very young students, and they'll tell us not about their houses. They'll tell us about their Christmas presents that they barely got to play with, or their bicycles that are no longer with them. And then they start telling us stories about the rest of their family members, right? They have grandparents whose houses have burned down, and aunts and uncles. It's catastrophic what they're experiencing right now.
Is there anything you can do to help them?
Yes. Right now, we're fighting really hard to find a facility that will let us house our entire school body. Because right now, when our students have lost everything, the very least we can do is provide a space for them to be consistently every day with people that know them. Our school already focuses on social emotional health, so we're able to provide all of those services. We just need a space to be together.
Tell me a little bit about the kind of community that you served in Altadena, wasn't it?
Right, yes. We're in Altadena. We're a very diverse school. We have a lot of ethnicities present. We have a high special education population. And we're a very unique group. We're parents and community members that chose an alternative school for our students. And that's why we value it. And we've already built this school from just an idea up to a full TK through eighth grade school. And we did it through COVID. We built the school online, and we're prepared to build it this next time. We're ready.
And what about you? How are you holding up?
Thank you for asking. It's not easy when you talk to our kids, you talk to our families. They're going through so much, and they're just looking at me hoping for that school to reopen. So we're giving it day and night trying to find that facility because we have to reopen.
That was Bonnie Brimicombe, principal of Odyssey Charter School in Altadena, which was burnt down in the Los Angeles fires. We go now to South Africa, where 26 miners, along with 9 bodies, have been brought to the surface after being in a shaft underground for over 2 months. They're part of a much larger group of illegal miners. No one is sure how many, who went down the shaft at Stilfontein after it had been abandoned. The authorities at first tried to force them out, but over the weekend became part of the rescue operation. Local support groups have been trying to provide food and water. But a trade union official, Mametlwe Sebe, said those rescued so far were in a desperate condition.
Their state is very dire. The reality is that completely emaciated, completely dehydrated, in a very dire state physically. And it is very clear to us that they would require an urgent medical attention just in terms of their physical condition. Obviously, there would be also a need for attention in terms of the psychological trauma and other things.
Well, I spoke earlier to the BBC's Africa correspondent, Mayeni Jones, in Johannesburg, and she first gave me the background to this saga.
The story started in November when these illegal miners were discovered in this disused shaft in Stilfontein. It's a mining town about 2.5 hours drive from Johannesburg, southwest. And at the time, the authorities decided to take a very hard line on them. One minister said in November that they would smoke them out. They would wait, not provide them with any food or water until they came out, and then they would arrest them because they wanted to offer some sort of deterrent to anybody else who might want to engage in illegal mining. Now, unfortunately, what this has led to is a standoff between the miners and the authorities.
And have at any point during the past couple of months the miners underground been getting any food and water?
So this is what the authorities say. They say they have been getting food or water, that volunteers have, you know, been around the mines, have sent food down to them. And a number of miners were able to make their way out of the shaft. So the police said that this is evidence that if they wanted to come out, they would. And the only reason why they didn't come out is because they were trying to evade arrest. This is disputed by workers' unions and activist groups representing the miners. They say they have rights. They say a lot of them have been weakened by spending so long on the ground without food or water and were unable to come out themselves. And they said that the police have also impeded people from coming out.
So are the authorities now involved in an active attempt to get those men who are underground back to the surface, or is this being done by the mining unions and others?
Yes, so now, as of Friday, the High Court here in South Africa ordered the government to start a rescue operation. This started on Monday, and it's been organized by the government. The armed forces are also there, but there's also a body representing mining companies that is also bearing some of the cost of this rescue operation.
And those brought to the surface so far seem to be in a pretty bad condition.
Absolutely. The videos that were released by the unions over the weekend shows them looking emaciated, very weak. One of their representatives said that they're severely dehydrated and they're in dire need of medical aid in the first instance. But he also said that longer term, they might need psychological support for what they've seen there. Many of the miners claim that there are over 100 bodies rotting in that shaft and asked for face masks to help them deal with the smell. So it's pretty horrible conditions.
So there are videos of those who have been brought to the surface and video of those still underground.
Absolutely. This rescue operation is expected to take several days. There, we don't know exactly how many miners are below, but estimates put it at between 400 and 800 of them. So it's going to take several days because there's only one cage that's on a crane that's been lowered deep into the shaft, which is 2 kilometers deep, so pretty deep. And it goes down every hour and it brings back, you know, six to seven miners at a time, depending on their weight. So the authorities are estimating that it will take at least a week and potentially up to 16 days to get them out.
And any independent verification of the number who have died underground?
Unfortunately not, because this video was released by the mining union. They said it was filmed by the miners down there and they've shared it on social media. So a lot of the kind of data that would be attached to the video isn't available. We've asked for an original copy of the video so that we can try and verify it ourselves, but we haven't gotten it yet.
That was Mayeni Jones in Johannesburg with the news that 26 miners, along with 9 bodies, have been brought to the surface at the Stilfontein mine outside Johannesburg after being in a shaft underground for over 2 months. And don't forget, if you want to listen to NewsHour but miss the live broadcast, a podcast of the program is available, updated twice a day. Just type into your search engine BBC NewsHour podcast and you'll find it there. You can also subscribe to the feed if you want to receive it on a regular basis. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Few places in the world feel more remote than the snow-covered peaks of Greenland. At the world's largest island that sits beneath the North Pole, is home to fewer than 60,000 people, but now it finds itself at the centre of a geopolitical storm. As Donald Trump says, he wants to buy the independent territory, currently part of Denmark, for what he calls economic security, and he hasn't ruled out military force to take control. So what do the Greenlanders themselves want? Our correspondent Fergal Keane has been to visit.
It is one of the world's last wild frontiers, glimpsed in the short winter sunlight. We're travelling into a place of pristine beauty that's suddenly been overtaken by diplomatic crisis.
This place is so remote that it's hard to imagine it as the front line of a major geopolitical row. But up and down this fjord in isolated settlements and across the island of Greenland, they're talking about Trump.
Those who live here know the strain of harsh weather and the demands of survival. Timmerik Hansen and his family hunt and raise sheep for a living.
What do you feel about Trump?
What the stupid human in the world like a Trump. We need to work together with US, not Trump.
there's worry here. An Inuit culture that struggled against Danish colonialism doesn't want any new power taking over. Kalirak Ringsted is a village pastor.
In our opinion, it's wild and weird to hear him speak of our country as something that can just be bought. We don't view it as a purchasable land. We have been here for a long time. We are used to our ways of living.
In the capital, Nuuk, there's a feeling that the Trump intervention has brought world attention to Greenland's campaign for independence. And there's pragmatism, a desire for strong links and financial help from America and Denmark.
What is necessary here is that Greenland, as a sovereign state, should negotiate directly with the United States and not Denmark.
The Eskimo are very primitive, and the Danish government is doing its best to keep civilization from spoiling them.
To understand what Greenlanders feel about the colonial past, it's important to know about racism and abuses.
Some home when a ship comes in.
Hedvig Friedrichsen was only 14 when Danish officials fitted her with a contraceptive coil without her permission in the 1970s. She's one of over 100 women suing Denmark for its efforts to limit Greenland's population.
It was a very awful experience. I was still a child. It was just awful. I think the Danish people looked down on us, especially back then.
What do you need Denmark to do?
I want them to apologise.
However mighty, those wanting to control this land must reckon with an enduring struggle for dignity and self-determination.
Fergal Keane reporting from Greenland. We all get tired in the course of a day. In fact, one in eight people in the UK report being tired all the time, according to a recent survey. But how do other people pick up on your fatigue? Well, it seems that people tend to underestimate how tired women are and overestimate how tired men are. Researchers at the US space agency NASA have discovered that despite feeling fatigued, women still put more effort into being sociable and expressive when speaking to others, while men are less likely to do the same if they're tired. Novelist Louise Mumford knows all about fatigue. She's an insomniac and has written a thriller called Sleepless. Do NASA's findings chime with her own experience?
Along with many women who have read that article today, we're probably not that surprised by the findings. I think generally women are the better communicators between the two sexes. So the fact that even when we are tired, we are still putting the effort into the body language, making eye contact, all of that sort of thing, that doesn't surprise me at all. Women, I believe, also do take a lot of the emotional load of the general day-to-day life. The majority are the primary caregivers for children, or they're looking after elderly parents. And those responsibilities, you can't just go, I'm sorry, I'm tired today. I can't listen to you properly, because life has to go on. Life continues and they have to deal with the day-to-day issues.
So carry on regardless, stiff upper lip, all that sort of thing.
In many ways, yes. I think it's because very often in the incredibly busy lives that we have, women are doing not only this emotional load that I talked about, but they're also holding down jobs. You know, they are doing all sorts of different things. Whereas often men can sometimes have a little bit more opportunity to go, I'm really tired today. I don't want to do this bit, whatever it is that they feel that they can't do. And so women do generally, I think, just kind of keep calm and carry on.
Have you ever suffered from crippling fatigue, such that you are in fact unable to function?
At very low points, yes. After about a week of very disrupted sleep, you kind of hit a wall, really, where you give out the energy that you need for the little bits in the day that you can do, and then you just kind of power down almost. And so, yes, I have experienced that. And I'm also very aware that in those times, I wouldn't do things like driving, for example. I think that would be incredibly dangerous. So, yes, I think I have occasionally in my life reached those points, and they are very grim.
Should people be more understanding, do you think, of, be they men or women, who say they are tired for whatever reason?
Sleep is a consumerist function now, and there are lots of things that are marketed for people who can't sleep, which conversely often makes them feel worse. We are all up too late. Our mobile phones, social media, television, everything is designed to keep us awake, to keep us alert, to keep us scrolling. And so we can all learn to be a little bit more empathetic, can't we?
That was novelist Louise Mumford, an insomniac who's written a book called Sleepless. And she was talking there about researchers at the US space agency NASA discovering that despite feeling fatigued, women still put more effort into being sociable and expressive than men. That's it from this edition of NewsHour from me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London. Goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.